This is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, Vice President of Security Technology at Synopsys and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Synopsys and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.sigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 134th in a series of monthly interviews with security gurus, and I'm pleased to have today with me Kelly Jackson Higgins. Hi, Kelly.
Hi, Gary.
Kelly Jackson Higgins is executive editor at darkreading.com. Kelly is an award-winning veteran technology journalist with over 20 years of experience as a reporter and an editor. Publications Kelly's been associated with include Network Computing, Secure Enterprise Magazine, Communications Week, Virginia Business Magazine, and a few others. Kelly's coverage of computer security, aka cyber, is award-winning. Kelly has a BA in English from William & Mary, where she played on the women's soccer team. She lives outside of Charlottesville, Virginia, in a semi-empty nest due to college, kind of just like me. There are no kids left, right?
Right. Yeah, well, one comes and goes. The other one visits on weekends.
We're down to zero. So there's milk in the refrigerator. That's the main thing.
So yeah, you got to have the food there just in case.
Yeah, exactly. So as the executive editor of one of the most important security website outlets, you have a really unique perspective on the security industry. So how do you separate the signal from the noise when it comes to news and security?
That's a great question, Gary, because that gets harder every day. We get so much thrown at us, and there's so much going on, as you know. So we really have to, every day I spend early in the morning, I'm in here sort of, I guess, triaging, as I would describe it, looking at things we're working on, longer-term things we're working on, new things that are happening, and determining whether it's something that's really real and impactful and will be interesting to our readers. And so I have to sit there and figure that out every day and then find the our folks to cover the things, or in some cases write them myself. So it's definitely challenging. We never have a day we don't have something to write about. A lot of things do get left on the floor just because they're just too much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
which is a good thing. It's not a bad thing.
So, I mean, it is a good thing, but you know, how much more is there now, and how has it grown over time? I'm sort of interested in that.
Yeah, well, I know early on, like when we first started, it'll be 11 years in early May, which is incredible to me.
Wow.
It'll be 11 in early May.
Yeah.
I was looking back at some of my really old stories back in 2006, and so long ago.
I used to write for you guys back then, remember?
I know. You were one of our bloggers, yeah.
Yeah.
So back then, you know, we had, things were so new, like, you know, a new malware variant was a huge story, you know, and or, you know, a bug. Like, I remember H.G. Moore's month of browser bugs. Those
mm-hmm.
were really big stories.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and now we've kind of matured where we have, you know, these bug bounty programs. We have, you know, malware is now specific, like ransomware variants are a big story.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of back then, there weren't a lot of, you know, big data breach stories. They were kind of few and far between. But that's what's really, I think, picked up over the last few years, too, is the actual attack groups, attack targets. So there's more incidents to write about, too,
sure,
in addition
yeah.
to the technology.
Yeah.
And I would say the technology has evolved a lot in some ways, but not much in other ways.
Yeah, that's funny. And I'm sure that you get pitches from vendors just like all the time. This is the most important story on Earth, and our little thing seems to help.
Yes, everyone's product is going to fix everything and is not hackable.
So far, untrue, all these things.
Yeah, exactly.
So I want to ask you a little bit of a tricky question with regard to that. So what role do advertisers and sponsors play in Dark Reading's coverage?
Actually, none. The only thing we have on our site that would maybe answer that question, we have a sponsored column section.
Oh, okay.
Where sponsors might write something that we don't, you know, we don't have anything to do with the content, but we don't edit it. We just edit it for copy editing. But in terms of what we cover, I personally try not to pay attention. That sounds really naive and possibly lame, but I try not to pay attention to who's advertising on our site.
Right.
And not that it would affect me, but I just feel like I don't want to think about it.
Don't want to know about it. Yeah, that seems so like a reasonable policy.
Yeah.
Hard to do, but
yeah,
reasonable.
Yeah. It's not like we don't know who's advertising, but that definitely does not impact what we cover.
Yeah. Yeah, that's always a tricky bit. I mean, you know, journalism has changed an absolute ton in the last 20 years. I know you wrote for your high school paper and you wrote for the college paper, And I'm interested to hear from your perspective what's changed or maybe what's not changed when it comes to journalism in the last 20 years.
Oh, yeah, that's an understatement. It has really dramatically shifted. Back in the day, your biggest concern was reporting on your story, and you had this long process of editing, and, you know, and the layers of people could be like three people editing your story, and it would take a while to get it, you know, published. You had the print side of it. Now with, you know, when we first started out, dark reading was always online only, so yeah. We had that sort of as our advantage to start out, but a lot of pubs had to switch to that.
Yep.
I remember the days when you would write stuff for the print pub and the leftovers, quote unquote, went online.
It wasn't called premium content.
No, it was just, throw that up on the web.
Yeah. I remember writing columns that were actually published on paper back in the day. And then when I switched to you guys, it was like, wow, this is just web only. Holy cow.
Yeah, I think we don't have the luxury of time anymore, I will say that. And because in our industry especially, things are changing so dramatically all the time. Like the threats are changing. There's something new happening all the time that, you know, you're constantly under the gun to, you know, crank stuff out, think on your feet. Mm-hmm. And I think journalists in general, what we've learned with the journalism business is not just about the reporting. You have to have, you know, an online presence. You have to have a social media presence. You do... you do talks and you moderate panels, your public speaking becomes part of your persona.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of skill sets that we may not have been trained at we're learning on the job. At least I know in my case that was something that was, you know, a bit of an eye opener a few years ago. Was wow, I'm not just a writer anymore.
That's right. I'm a media personality.
But it's good. I mean, I think it's always, you know, like I always tell my kids, you know, your job, your career is going to evolve and change, and you're going to be learning all the time new skills, and you're not doing one finite set of things anymore, and that's actually a good thing. So it's, it can be challenging at times, but I think it's a good thing.
Yeah. I don't know. How important is social media to your work, would you say?
Well, interestingly, when I was one of the first Twitter users or whatever, members, I don't know what you call it, members of Twitter, back in the day.
And tweeters, back then, a lot of people call them tweeters.
Tweeters. I remember you were resistant to Twitter for a
while. Totally.
I remember that.
I got to tell you, the reason I started using Twitter is because we sold a company that I was an advisor to Twitter. And so I had this pre-IPO stock, and I had to decide, like, geez, I had to use the product and make everybody else use it. So I swore I was going to stop using Twitter the day I got rid of all that stock. And, of course, I got addicted instead.
Well, you know, what I think is interesting about Twitter is our industry is so Twitter-centric.
Yes.
There's so much conversation going on. A lot of times news is happening on Twitter. So
yep.
To me, Twitter is like my right hand. I mean, I have it up all day, you know, and, I don't necessarily tweet every 5 minutes, but, I definitely do communicate when there's a reason to, but mm-hmm. I basically am stalking people online with them on Twitter. But I think Twitter it's a really good, you know, it has its pros and cons, obviously. It's not a great place to have a long conversation, but
yeah.
I think it's a way to keep your hand in what's going on, and I like that about it. And it's definitely been a huge part of my job, and Workstate, we extend it a little bit to our, you know, Facebook page mm-hmm. and our LinkedIn groups, but mm-hmm. I think most people in security
do Twitter.
Seem to be all about Twitter.
Yeah. There are some new ones coming up. Have you heard of Mastodon?
No, I haven't heard of that one.
Yeah, the people are talking about that now. Who knows?
Huh.
I mean, the whole thing surprised me because, like you said, I was always very resistant to the idea of even less thought-out stuff. But it turns out if you follow the right set of people, it can be incredibly useful and very, very fast. Stuff does break on Twitter, and 2 days later we'll read about it in the Post, and it's like, wow, that's 2 days old. Yawn.
Well, I'll say every major news event that I've seen in the past 10 years or whatever it's been said on Twitter I saw first on Twitter. Maybe that I saw in the world, I saw first on Twitter before
right.
I read anywhere else.
Right,
so, yeah.
Right. Interesting. So slightly different question. What's more fun to cover, technology or business, or is that sort of a red herring question?
You mean in terms of business of our industry or business in general?
You get to make it up what I mean.
Okay. Well, I think for me it's a combination because I think our industry is the most interesting one out there right now.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, when you're combining like the effects of, you know, a cyber attack or the effects of, you know, what particular threat group is doing and how you're battling it or not able to battle it and how the techniques they're using, I think that's interesting. So it's both, I guess for me, it's both the business and the technical piece.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's hard. I wrote some general business pieces back in the day. And they were fun to do, but they weren't as challenging as this. You know,
gotcha.
Every day, to me, this job's challenging.
Yeah, and I mean, certainly the technology and the business of computer security or cybersecurity has gotten bigger and bigger and the business aspects alone require coverage of their own in some sense.
Yeah.
But you can't do definitely. It without having a technical clue. Otherwise, you just get spurious coverage.
Right. And that thing is, you know, really fun to me to drill down on some of these things, and because, you know, you're learning about it and you get sort of a body of knowledge, but then there's always new things happening that you need to learn about. So I like that too.
So politics and security are intersecting these days more than ever. And I'm wondering how, as the person in charge, dark reading approaches thorny, unresolved issues like crypto backdoors and WikiLeaks and Snowden and Russian information warfare and so on.
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, the Snowden thing early on was a little bit of a challenge for us because, well, first of all, we didn't have the original documents like some of the ones that were leaked to them. So we were trying to parse out what would, you know, an enterprise security person want to know about this? Mm-hmm. How would this affect them? So we tended to, we were a little less on the privacy aspects and more on the insider threat stuff, for example. Uh-huh, you know, yeah. How your company wouldn't become the next Edward Snowden.
Don't get
that kind
Snowden.
Of thing. We looked at, yeah, exactly. I mean, we did a little bit of the privacy stuff, but I think for our readers, the more interesting pieces were the takeaways for what this means for their organizations. I mean, if the NSA is getting owned, you know, what does that mean for me? You know, that kind of thing.
So. Right. How about things that, you know, really take kind of a technical versus political stance, like crypto backdoors? Do you guys worry about that issue, or do you try to ignore that?
I mean, I don't think ignore it. I think we haven't done as much on that. We did cover the WikiLeaks stuff around the election time, because I think the election hacking was a whole other animal in cyber espionage, which we cover regularly. I thought that was really interesting shift.
Yeah,
so we definitely covered that from the perspective of the threat groups and how the Russian hacking groups were changing their game a little bit against the U.S. I thought that was really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Crypto backdoor stuff we've covered, but, you know, I guess our readers are more interested in it from the security aspects, so that's kind of the angle that we've looked at.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's hard enough to build applied crypto that works without trying to put a backdoor in it and not screw that up.
Well, so. And I think we've been writing, it seems like I've been writing about encryption for forever, and in some ways, we've not really moved the needle too far, right? We're still moving that direction, but it's taken a really long time
for encryption
to be a normal, an everyday thing.
Yeah, it's because it's hard. And people who try to make it easy don't do it wrong, generally speaking. So
right.
There's like a whole bunch
of
broken crypto on your phone. It's broken right now.
Yep.
We'll be right back after this message. If you like what you're hearing on Silver Bullet, make sure to check out my other projects on GaryMcGraw.com. There you can find writings, videos, and even original music. Do you think that fake news is at its heart an information security issue?
The stuff that we saw purportedly from Russia, you mean? Like
no,
the
not necessarily just from Russia. I just mean, you know, disinformation, the fake news thing.
Well, I think part of the problem right now in our industry and just in general with journalism being so rapid fire, online, quick to get things up, is there is some misinformation that gets sent out early sometimes when things happen or when news breaks. Sometimes publications and people get it wrong. So that's always the tricky balance, is being, you know, time sensitive on a story, but also making sure it's accurate and you really drill beyond the face value of the development or the topic. We see people jump to conclusions a lot in our industry, especially that's the downside of Twitter.
Uh-huh.
Is people tend to sort of throw out their thoughts before they really thought it through.
Hot
sometimes.
Take.
Exactly. There's some fun to that, but there's also some danger to that.
I don't know. It gets hits. I mean, really BuzzFeed has kind of built their whole little world on that, I think.
And we try, our goal is to be more, this is sort of in our unique value that we've tried to build is, you know, really having a more in-depth looking beyond just the face value of the news for a big story. It's like really kind of stepping back and looking at it from different angles. So that's, you know, not just the news itself, but what it means to, you know, organizations, to readers, and the big picture. That's the fun part, actually.
Mm-hmm. That's a good answer. So our kids have all grown up and flown the coop. And I wonder how being a tech-savvy mom impacted your journalism.
My journalism or
your journalism?
My kids?
No, I don't know. I think your kids impacted your. Maybe it was the other way around. Who knows?
I don't know. I don't know if I was tech savvy right away. I mean, I think I've always been interested in technology, so I think I was an early adopter to a lot of things.
Yeah.
And I tend to be a little paranoid. Like, for a long time, my Twitter feed was private. And I realized that wasn't super helpful, like, if I was involved in conversations on Twitter. Right. So I had to open it, and that was, like, a big moment.
Yeah.
And I'm one of the people on staff who's always bugging people about reminding them of security best practices and things like that. And my kids will tell you that I annoyed them forever about security, but they're both very security savvy. They both use VPNs. They make strong passwords. They're telling their friends what they're doing wrong. So
that's hilarious. See, and they learned that from you, yeah. Presumably.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Because not my husband.
Did the tables turn? Like, in my house, you know, Jack learned an absolute ton from me. And then he started teaching me about stuff. He demanded we switch to Macs. He tells us what phones to buy to this day. Did that happen at your house, too?
So every once in a while, like, wait a minute. You told us to do this. Right. You have those moments where you can cut a corner, but I think I drill it in them pretty well, because they take it pretty seriously, and they're pretty, I think they honestly appreciate why and understand it. So
oh,
and they make
cool.
them a little bit paranoid sometimes, I don't know.
Well, you know, they grew up with this stuff, so they actually see it a little bit differently than we do. Although,
oh,
I mean, I started using computers at 16, so that's pretty young, but zero is a lot younger than that.
Yeah, no, I dove in early before it was easy to use, and hated it, a lot of the technology back then. And then as it got easier, I appreciated it a lot more. So I was always interested in how things worked. So
yes.
Even as an English major.
Well, there you go.
Tinkering with applications all the time.
That's good. So, well, I got a degree in philosophy, which is even more useless than English. So I don't know what to tell you.
Hey, I think they're both very useful in this industry. I argue that liberal arts is actually a big helper in this industry in terms of thinking. And I mean, look at you.
Joking aside, I totally agree with you. And I think that one thing that happened in computer security is that people came from a lot of diverse fields and all came together to really change stuff about 20 years ago. And I hope we don't lose that. I hope it doesn't become over-professionalized in a sense that, you know, people with a really unique perspective don't get listened to as we go forward.
Yeah, well, I remember, you know, the early people, I remember we did some profile pieces on dark reading early on to kind of get to know people in the industry. And so many of the pioneers I read about either were dropped out of high school, dropped out of college, you know, were just learning as they went along. They were basically building the tech, building the industry themselves by just doing it. You know, so I think that creativity and that, you know, mindset of, you know, creating like this industry sort of started out is still a big piece of it. And I think that's something, you're right, I don't think we should lose that. I think that's a big element of why we are where we are today in the industry.
Cool. So a little bit of a difficult question. Sitting on the journalistic side, or the journalist side of the table in tech, gives you a whole bunch of power. And so I'm wondering if you experience the same kinds of sexism that other women in tech experience, even if you're on that kind of powerful side of the table.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, over the years, I've had various experiences. When I was younger, I wasn't very good about standing up for myself or, you know, speaking out about it. But I think women today are much more empowered. You're seeing that a lot in the news lately, and just in terms of, you know, the whole movement of victim issues. And I feel like that's something now I'm more comfortable dealing with than I was, you know, maybe 20 years ago. But yeah, unfortunately, it's a thing. You know, people make a comment. You know, I'm usually the only woman in the room in a lot of cases. And I grew up with two brothers, and I was a tomboy, so I was used to being, you know, the only girl in the room type thing, so I don't really worry about it, but it does come up sometimes, and you can definitely sense comments or, you know, way people might talk to you or treat you, and it's a shame to me that's still happening, but, you know, I think women are getting better at speaking up about it now, so I think that's really important.
That is important. Are there things that, you know, we should do collectively to eradicate this problem, or do you have any ideas for that?
This is something I think about all the time, and I'm actually in the process of working on a panel for Black Hat about diversity, and this is it's such a big question. There's so many cultural issues that are hard to beat. You know, people grow up thinking a certain way, or, you know, they subconsciously judge somebody based on, you know, what they look like or what sex they are, and, you know, that kind of thing. There's always that sort of, people come up their sort of preconceived notions and biases, so it's hard to me, that's a tough thing to break, but I think the more it's talked about, the better. I mean, that's one thing I've noticed is now this is more in the topic of public conversation in our country and in our society and in our security community. I think that helps a lot. I think it makes people more aware of, you know, that it is an issue, and even just checking your own biases at the door. I mean, everyone has their own biases too, right? Whether they won't have them or not. So I think that's really the key, is just keep talking about it. And I don't know how you fix it, but I think awareness, and that sounds so hokey, but awareness and just, you know, being open about it is half the battle, I think, in the end, to sort of changing the mindset, changing the behaviors.
I buy that. I mean, that's sort of sunlight as the best antiseptic approach. And
yeah, and I think when I was younger, that it wasn't talked about. That's why I, a couple times, should have spoken up, and I didn't, right? I just kind of let it go and, oh, you know, I'm embarrassed. I should have maybe said something to somebody that happened, or I should have, you know, told this guy that was an inappropriate comment or whatever.
Yeah.
But I didn't. I just kept quiet, and that was stupid, but I didn't know any differently. That's how it was handled.
Right.
Know, so.
Right. But that, you think that was partially the just the way things were back then, and they're getting better?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I think people just didn't talk about it, right? So, you know, you can look back at some, you know, issues I've had on college campuses as well. That's definitely a topic of conversation now, where it wasn't when I was in college. You know, you didn't talk about it, except you whispered about it or you heard stories about it. You didn't really speak up. So I that's why I think talking about these things and doing them light of day is probably going to help. It won't fix things, but it'll definitely make it, you know, easier to handle it when it happens.
So now a completely off the wall question. When you played soccer at William & Mary, did you predate U.S. Women's National Head Coach Jill Ellis, or did you play with Jill Ellis?
I played with Jill Ellis,
oh, cool.
As a matter of fact.
Do you still keep in touch?
I sure do. I'm going to see her tomorrow, as a matter of fact. We have a big soccer anniversary weekend at William & Mary for the first time. They're commemorating the beginning of the program.
Awesome.
And she will be there. So we're all going to be catching up this week. I have a core group of teammates. We're still really close all over the country, but we get together at least once or twice a year, and we see Jill probably every 2 years now, but she keeps in touch with us, and we get to see her this weekend.
Very so, cool. Yeah. Well, that's neat.
We're very proud of her.
No doubt. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then last question, what book are you currently reading? I just started Daniel Suarez's new book, The Change Agent, last night, which is, you know, kind of ridiculous science fiction fun stuff. But what do you like to read? What are you reading now?
Okay, you're gonna laugh at me. I was an English major, so I still like to read my literature.
Oh, me too. So I read a bunch of literature.
I just finished, for some reason, I never read Maya Angelou's I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings. I just finished that this week.
Wow.
And I'm getting ready to do my second pass at Trinity, which was one of my favorite novels years ago about Ireland. And we just had a trip to Ireland this fall, and I wanted to reread it.
Wow.
After having been there. So I'm getting ready to read that again, which is a very long book, but it's awesome.
Yeah.
And then I read, at the same time, I usually read a nonfiction book.
Huh.
And I've got like three of them in the works. One of them's a Bruce Springsteen's book.
I've heard that's good, actually. I'm not a big Bruce Springsteen's music fan, but he's an interesting fellow for sure.
Yeah, well, I've been a huge fan for a long time, and I've heard him do some readings of the book, and it's really well done. So I started reading that. My daughter got me that for Christmas. So
that's great.
Yeah.
What are the other two nonfiction ones?
Well, there's actually another book. One of my favorite authors is Toni Morrison. There's a book I just got from her. It's called Conversations with Toni Morrison. So she talks about all of her. I've read all of her books at least twice, so I'm just reading her voice, just interviews she's had. So. And then, let's see, what else? Look at my pile as you asked me this.
Sorry. Yeah, I have a hard time remembering myself. Yeah. Like, I just read this great book that I gave to Amy, and she's reading it. I can't remember the title of it.
Yeah, I can't find the other one, but I usually have, like, two or three books going at the same time. So
That's
kind of how I do it. But I tend to read older fiction. I tend to not be reading the newest books. I'm always behind.
Uh-huh. So. But a big reader. Yeah. So that's your English major roots didn't go away.
They did not go away. I still appreciate my good literature. So.
Very cool. Well, thanks for your time today. It's been a really interesting conversation.
Yeah, thank you, Gary. It was great. Thanks for having me.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Synopsys and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by Search Security. The January-February issue of IEEE S&P Magazine includes our interview with Marie Moe, a Norwegian researcher who hacks her own pacemaker. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.sigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.